ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming is expanding to keep pace with your world.
Because keeping up can be a challenge.
And events can feel overwhelming beyond our understanding.
What might Xi Jinping do next?
What hand is Trump hiding?
Join me, Hamish McDonald, Geraldine Doogue, Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Four voices bringing perspective, experience and energy to the big global stories.
Global roaming. Weekdays at 11 on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen.
And welcome to Big Ideas. Natasha Mitchell with three very big thinkers today. They've each won perhaps the biggest accolade that a thinker can win, a Nobel Prize. And they all did the winning work as young scientists at the Australian National University, which is where a huge audience joins you on Ngunnawal and Ngambri country today, co-hosted by the Swiss Embassy in Australia. Astrophysicist and former Vice-Chancellor of the ANU, Professor Brian Schmidt, won a Nobel Prize in 2011 for the discovery that the universe is expanding at an accelerating rate. Now, this was a finding that really upended our understanding of cosmology, dark energy, and the potential fate of the universe.
It may be that dark energy is changing, and so we actually don't know what's going to happen.
So maybe we'll all coalesce again.
Yeah, well, so I'm not sure that's better. I think the Gnab-Gib... Things crunching together, I'm not sure I like that better than the thing that lasts forever.
Yes, how will it all end? You and I will not be here to find out. Australian vet turned immunologist and former Australian of the Year, Professor Peter Doherty, and Swiss scientist, Professor Rolf Zinkernagel, won their 1996 Nobel Prize for a discovery about how immune systems identify what cells to kill.
I've known people in biomedical science particularly who seem terrified of discovering anything because they'll have to go up against the established credo. And we were so ignorant that we didn't give a damn. No, what the hell, you know?
And they transformed our understanding of how our immune system recognises and responds to invading viruses, infected cells and transplanted organs, importantly, laying the path for new vaccines, for new treatments for inflammatory diseases and cancer and much more. And the three Nobels are joining me today to talk curiosity, discovery and the state of science.
Please join me in welcoming them and our moderator, Natasha Mitchell, with the warm applause they richly deserve. Thank you.
Lovely to see you all. Welcome, welcome. Look, gentlemen, Nobel Prizes were discoveries that really broke radical new ground in your fields. And so the response was interesting at the time. What was the state of mind that you possessed as young men? You were in your 20s and 30s when you did this work. How would you describe that state of mind? Brian?
1998, I had my second son. Still didn't have a permanent job. I had come this close to not having a job at all in astronomy. Made this discovery with the big team. And it just seemed, it wasn't a discovery to me in 1998. It was evidence for something crazy.
Really crazy,
right? The universe is 70% of the universe we didn't know about. So I was worried. My state of mind was, I know this is what we're seeing and it's probably right, but, you know, what about the unknown unknowns? Donald Rumsfeld has come along and, you know, I was worried about something coming up that no one had ever thought about that would make it go away. So I found it deeply uncomfortable because it just seemed too crazy to be true.
What pressed you on?
Well, I wanted to find out. And, you know, if you find something that's too crazy to be true, it's best that you figure out it's too crazy to be true rather than someone else. So I'm trying to figure out what's going on.
And hence a Nobel Prize. Rolf Zinkernagel, what about you? How would you describe your young state of mind when you were doing this key work with Peter here, right here on campus?
Well, probably I did not have a mind, you know. I just came to Australia to do some work on immunity against certain bacteria. So I started out with that, but I landed together with Peter in a lab and we started to do experiments on a very particular virus. And by doing so, we were extremely lucky to find something nobody had thought of about, or we didn't sleep it over. So we just found something that upset everybody.
I mean, I think that takes courage as a young scientist to upset your seniors, surely.
Well, it wasn't us, it was the finding, you know. So.
Well, I think it was you two a bit as well.
I understand there was a bit of a shared love of opera. Was this part of the kind of creative spark that
You're
drove this science?
You're absolutely right. And you see, it worked.
Yeah, Rolf sang. That was one of the reasons they put him in the lab with me, because the labs at the old John Curtin School were tiny. They were developed for a totally different era of science. And Rolf came out to work with a guy called Bob Blandon, who had done some wonderful experiments, really wonderful experiments. And that was one of the reasons I was there too. I'd been working as a veterinary pathologist. I'm a vet. I'm the only vet to ever have won a Nobel Prize. So I was headed for a big senior job in CSIRO in Melbourne. But I'd been doing science for 9 or 10 years. But I decided I didn't know any immunology. And Rolf still thinks I don't know any. But I decided I'd come to the John Curtin School for a couple of years. I knew someone there and try and learn some immunology before I took this job with CSIRO's. So they found a bit of money to pay me and came back with a wife and 2 little kids with wonderful Scottish accents. We'd been in Edinburgh. And I started to work. And then after about a year or so, and I'd been doing some fairly nice experiments, I thought, and Rolf turned up. They couldn't stand the singing, so they put him in with me, and we got on okay. I mean, you know, Rolf says he's from the William Tell tradition. He's a straight shooter, and we sort of clicked, and we designed an experiment, which went in retrospect. It's a totally stupid experiment. It could never have shown what we wanted it to show. The systems went.
What did you want it to show?
Oh, it doesn't really matter.
Right. But it didn't win the Nobel Prize, people.
It just couldn't have. The sensitivity of the systems was such, you just couldn't have actually done it. But it showed us something totally different, and it was all or none. It was fantastic.
I mean, so in the moment, when you make that discovery or series of discoveries,
yeah.
Do you understand the consequence of what you found?
Not really, but you know it's different and you know it's big. The transplant people had been working since the 1930s, studying transplantation in mice, trying to work out graft rejection and how it works and graft acceptance, and had been back-crossing, brother-sister mating of mice to breed all sorts of substrains. And basically, we were able to tap into this incredible technology and just infect these mice with some viruses and really map out the whole thing and show what was going on. It was an extraordinary experience, and we were extraordinarily lucky.
Mm. You mentioned, Brian Schmidt, that you were a young father at the time and your second child had come along. And so this is a question that gets asked of women scientists. How on earth did you do fathering and science at the same time?
So I think my wife would say I took some shortcuts at the time, but it's intense, right? You during these times when you're young and you would know working in the lab, you're trying to do many things at the same time, and it is a very intense part of your life.
And you become obsessional.
Yeah, but you know, you're also obsessing over, you know, young children as well, because you have no choice. So I don't know. It's a short crazy part of people's lives. And anyone who remembers or has currently small kids, you, after 3 years, you kind of try to remember what happened and you don't, because it's all kind of a fog. Part of the fog is doing the science, I guess, true, at the same time.
What, yeah, what about you, Rob?
At the time, I was lucky to have a medico wife who tried to work a little bit at Woden Valley Hospital here. We'd had two small kids, 12 months and 2.5 years. And out of our today's perspectives, you cannot take care maximally or even optimally to all these problems. So my wife basically took care of the kids. It was not easy for my wife. It was very easy for me.
Yeah, we both had incredibly supportive wives. Through that period, there were almost no family photographs. We were just working absolutely flat out. It was an incredible opportunity, and we just went for it. But we were also in the Hughes ghetto, a sort of U-shaped lot of houses which had postdoctoral people and visiting people and so forth. And on the outer side were the PhD students who had families. But this was an incredibly supportive environment. We carpooled with people from that group. Yep. We still got great friends from them. And it was a different
era. And the kids roamed free then. I mean, that's how it worked, wasn't it?
It was a great time, actually.
A different time. But, yeah. Let's consider what makes an environment conducive to smart research, to curiosity-driven discovery of the kind that you all achieved. Brian, and you've run a university now, so you've got a sort of sense...
Not anymore, thank God.
Yeah, yeah. He's free now, he's liberated from being Vice-Chancellor of ANU. And I think it's interesting to think of your experience and the environment that you worked in and how that compares to the environment that young people do science in today, where often if they're doing a PhD, it's strictly 3 years and then they're out. There's a lot of pressure on universities to keep students moving through the system. Tell us about the environment that you found yourself in and whether students today have the same.
You know, research is ultimately quite a creative process. And the whole point of doing research is not doing stuff you already know. It's doing stuff you don't know. So you need to be prepared to take risks. And to take risks, you got to have an environment that's stable enough to know that you have a chance to fail and come back. And so when I arrived at ANU at the beginning of 1995, I essentially had a 3-year job. But that 3-year job really had anything you want. It was entirely up to me to do what I thought was good. There was a lot of supportive staff. I could talk. There was a little bit of resources, but not a lot. I spent $8,000 to win the Nobel Prize. That's the total amount. But I did have access to telescopes. So telescopes are expensive, but the amount of money, not so much. So you need an environment where you are able to kind of, you know, bet the farm a couple times. And that's what I found here. And that's the type of thing, there's not incremental. You just don't do little incremental things. And the system right now really does push incrementalism.
In what respect?
Well, you're kind of, you know, judged on 6 months, you know, what publications and how many did you get? And it's not really kind of lost the idea of quality. It's, you know, a lot of the measures are quantity. It's a real pressure cooker. Only 10% of the people really are going to get through a PhD these days and have a career in research. And it's, the measures are quite quantity driven. How many papers are you on?
And what impact does that have on, because I think we have to remember that most Nobel Prizes seem to be won by people at that phase of their career, early career researchers.
Yeah, you've got to be breaking the mold, taking some risks and asking questions that are hard, where you're not sure that you're going to get a paper out of it, right? And so I think the incrementalism we build in is where I just got to get this like portfolio of 12 papers by the time I finish
my... Meet your KPIs.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. It's really bad for creativity. And I think it's something we're going to have to think about within institutions of how do we protect young people to have that ability to be creative.
You mentioned failure and allowing failure. Tell us about that and why that is so fundamental to science.
You know, they say in Silicon Valley is you fail often, you fail fast. And scientists need to do that. You need to try stuff and you got to go, oh, that's not going to work. Stop, do the next thing. And you got to learn how to kind of be evolving what you're doing and pivoting and following your nose to what's interesting. So failure is trying something no one's done before, not knowing the answer. If you always get a publishable result, it's because you're doing nothing interesting. You're doing something you know is going to work that will change, you know, incrementally what research is, and that's fine. But we need to have the other bit as well. And let me say, there's a place for everyone. You can do the incremental research. We need that. But we also need people being prepared to take the big risk. And that's the part that I think is really being
so interesting. You talk about that if you only do the stuff that gets a publishable result, because that is such a big issue in science at the moment. Everyone's looking for a publication. I often think that we should have scientific papers on the things that haven't worked.
We're beginning to do that now too. But again, it doesn't get you your first job.
No, well, there you go. Pragmatics again. Rolf, what about you? You work in an innovation culture that is extraordinary. I mean, you've got half the population of Australia, yet two times the percentage of GDP is spent on research and development.
You know, I think there are three things at least you need to succeed in science. One is a little bit of money. Secondly, intelligence. And third, enormous amount of luck. And when you go back to Peter and my discovery, you have to realize that at the Don Curtin School at the time, there was one mouse strain with which we made most of the experiments. And when we did the experiment that, you know, was unlikely to shake the earth, and we found something that nobody else had seen before. Who could have planned that the right cell line and the right very frequent mouse strain should be used at Don Curtin? You can't do that.
It's interesting. You've mentioned luck twice tonight.
Yeah.
And I don't know that everyone would associate science with good luck.
Astronomical luck.
Yeah. Just incredibly lucky. But, you know, failure is essential in science. I mean, if you don't fail, you're not doing anything original. That's a basic fact. You know, you're not trying. And I've known people in biomedical science particularly who seem terrified of discovering anything, because they'll have to go up against the established credo.
Oh, that's very disturbing.
And we were so ignorant that we didn't give a damn. You know, what the hell, you know?
Be fearless and ceaselessly curious is a message I take from Peter Doherty. Three Nobel laureates on stage and Natasha Mitchell here with you on ABC Radio National's live event show, Big Ideas, joining you from the Australian National University with astrophysicist Brian Schmidt and immunologists Rolf Zinkernagel from Switzerland and Peter Doherty, who the Doherty Institute for Infection and Immunity in Melbourne is named after. Its team played a world-leading role during the COVID pandemic. I wonder what you think we're getting right in Australia and perhaps in Switzerland as well. What we're getting right now and what we could be doing differently when it comes to nurturing the next generation of scientists. Peter.
I think it's incredibly difficult at the moment to know, because we're going through massive transformative events. Biomedical biology at the stage we were doing, biomedical science, was before the molecular science revolution, which has totally transformed biology. And what's happened with that is the whole character of the thing has changed. And basically also what's come in is robotics, screening techniques where you can measure thousands of different things. And now we've got AI coming in. And actually, the data sets we have, and they are so vast that really you can't handle them without something like AI. You have to have it. So we're in this enormous transformative stage, but this kind of research we did as two young guys in a lab, and we wrote a research paper with two names on it. Now, a research paper will have 20 names on it. and in biology. And it'll have people from various subfields who we're relying totally on trust that they do things properly, because none of us can be across that whole research landscape in any detail. We can understand it superficially, but not in any depth. So it's transformed, and
Is there something to be said that the simple heart, though, of a well-designed experiment must survive if science is to survive? As things become more complex, more sophisticated, do we lose sight, perhaps, of the essence?
What happened is we made a discovery. A lot of this technology that we've got has the potential for discovery, but then you've still got to take that discovery and run it down and do the proper experiments and the proper studies.
And the thinking.
So that's more like what Rolf and I did. But the discovery process has been enhanced. But it's much harder for the young scientists now, I think, to differentiate themselves. And that's difficult. And also the job situation when we were doing this was terrific. And the job situation is complex.
Brian Schmidt, you've thought very deeply and advocated very vocally about the state of science in Australia. And last year at a National Press Club address, you said emphatically that you're scared for the future of science in this country. Why are you scared?
Well, I mean, on the plus side, Australia has a pretty flat social system along science. And so young people thrive here. They're not kind of pressed down by the old professors. That's a real strength of the system here. There's been money in the past, not a lot, but there's been enough. So we're kind of lean and mean. There has been great investment, for example, in biomedical into Melbourne, Sydney, and Brisbane especially.
Those big hubs of research.
Yeah, so there's real critical mass and this new way of doing research Peter just talked about works well, because they're about as big as any place in the world.
They're like little mini Silicon Valleys in a sense.
Yeah, in the research, there's the critical mass, so teams can do, kind of have the whole package there and work on it. So that's all great. The problem is, I think we take it for granted. We have relied on the funding of research to come from largely international students, such that international students fund a lot more Australian research than the Australian government does. Now,
which I think would shock some people to hear.
Well, and may I say, there is no other country in the world that this is true. This is uniquely Australia. And it's a good thing to a point.
And was that a clear policy decision on behalf of governments?
No, it was convenient. It's something that started and kind of ran away. It was just convenient for everyone to kind of let it go. But it's kind of got to the point where it's breaking things.
Well, then COVID happened and the bottom fell out of the international student market
The bottom fell out for only a little bit, scared us. But then we doubled down and we actually now have more student income going into research, less government investment in research. So it's actually, we're still doubling down on this. And so the challenge we have, if you're going to have a long-term research program, 20, 30 years, you kind of need to invest in it strategically. And when you're just relying on the ups and downs of universities getting international students to run a lot of it, that's not very strategic. So I think the government needs to sit down and say, for the national prosperity and our productivity, what is the research sovereign research system we want and need to give us a prosperous future? And then we need to fund that. What we don't say is, how much can we get away not funding and see what they, we'll just let them see what they do, which is what we're doing right now. There's almost no strategy. And the strategy has become that is there is very much in, let's not worry about the basic stuff like we've done. Let's just do the stuff that's good at the end and makes Australian companies.
So applied research over blue sky research.
That's right. And you want to have both. But at this point, we're really shifting away from blue sky research. And it's becoming incredibly focused at translation. And as I said, I want translation to happen. I do it and work on it myself. But if you get rid of all the basic stuff, it turns out the whole system just kind of is going to shrivel up and die.
So
and that's where I'm worried we're going.
Let's explore that further, because
if you don't have discovery, you don't have anything to translate.
A good example is the COVID vaccine. Yeah. So people, you know, there was an assumption that somehow they arrived in our arms a year after the pandemic began. The reality is, and you know this well, don't you, Rolf Zinkernagel, that was 30 years of work. And it kicked off with Kathleen Carrico, who was dogged against, the establishment, who said, well, what you're doing isn't worth doing. And yet she persisted, ultimately, with Drew Weissman, won a Nobel Prize.
True, but at the same time, it was a bad vaccine to choose for such a new fantastic technology, because even the best of these vaccines against COVID, like influenza, you can't do better than 60%. Whereas the classical vaccines against polio or smallpox, they cover almost 100%.
We'd never.
Politics comes in and says, hey, you're not worth what you say.
We'd never, because the human coronaviruses we were familiar with before, well, the original SARS and then MERS and then COVID-19, they weren't problematic. They caused respiratory infections. So nobody tried to make a human coronavirus vaccine. But what people didn't look at, and I should have, given my background, what they didn't look at was the experience with making coronavirus vaccines for a number of animal species, things like feline infectious peritonitis. Nobody has ever made a good coronavirus vaccine. So, you know, the best you can say of the coronavirus vaccines is they maybe keep you out of hospital. They don't stop you getting infected.
No, but I guess that why I brought that up was really to explore what is sometimes a fundamental misunderstanding about the way science works. And when you fund research for 3-year cycles and then you cut the funding and the research has to stop, is that a fundamental anathema to the way science has to work over the long term?
Yeah, I mean, you need long-term support. One of the things that's very much missing on the Australian scene, which is not the case in the Swiss scene, is the industry-based research component. We just have a very small science-based industry component. We have one outstanding company, CSL, which has been somewhat damaged by some decisions in the United States, but it's still a wonderful company that's doing fantastic science. But basically, industry in Australia and universities are simply not talking to each other in the way that they do, say, in Switzerland, in Germany, in Scandinavia. And that goes back more than 100 years. It goes back 120 years and more. And because they built close ties and they built technical universities who really did a fantastic job. So that, we suffer from the curse of natural resources.
So riding off the sheep's back, all the...
Well, the mining.
The open cut mines. Yeah. Rolf, how does that work in Switzerland, that relationship, and why is it so powerful, do you think, for social need?
I think I should clarify two things. First, universities and industry have always been close. That doesn't make both sides' life very easy, because, you know, who profits from whom? And I think Peter is completely right. Both profit a lot. And the second point is, you know, so-called basic science, long-term research, is a bit like art. You don't know whether tomorrow you paint a picture that makes you famous. It's not planable. But you can ask questions, and the important questions are often coming from industry. For example, in Basel was invented cyclosporine A, which is a very efficient immunosuppressant. That sole drug changed transplantation surgery completely. It made it possible.
And that came from industry?
That came from a screening program of industry, and didn't come from academic or university research. So, but, you know, in Basel particularly, where Roche and Novartis and many others are...
And you sat on as a non-executive board director on Novartis correct. For a
and
decade.
There is also a very healthy competition. You know, let's find out. And whether it happens in industry or university, who cares? Let's find out.
Yeah. Competition and cooperation is such an interesting tension in science, isn't it? Peter, you wanted to add.
Well, you know, but then, for instance, the greatest life-saving drug in history probably are the statins and the blood pressure meds. But the statins came out of basic research at the University of Texas. So it'll come from different directions, really. And the United States particularly has been very good at taking university research and taking it into small biotech companies and so forth. In fact, often the researchers themselves have moved across in that direction. Very uncommon in Australia.
Yeah.
I think Americans are all raised with some sort of commercial instinct we lack.
Yeah.
They sell lemonade on street corners at the age of 7.
But also there's a huge philanthropic culture in America. And speaking of America, I mean, we should consider the American situation. They have been a scientific powerhouse, and not just domestically, but for the entire world, they've been a powerhouse, haven't they, Brian Schmidt? And I wonder how you see the current massive cutback of science funding, the attack on universities, the attack on, you know, trailblazing institutions like the NIH, National Institutes of Health. You know, they didn't just drive the research agenda of America, they drove the research agenda of the world. How do you see that playing out, not just for America, but for the rest of science? Has it had an impact on your field? And maybe it could be our gain. Their brain drain could be our brain gain.
We're not really sure how it's going to play out. So Congress has come back and reinstated most of the cuts, but not all. But there's huge uncertainty, the whole visa situation of people suddenly wondering, can I go there? Sensibly, or am I going to get locked up at the border? It's created essentially a blockage of people wanting to go and study or, you know, work in the United States.
Collaborate.
Relative to the past. And, you know, it's hard to convince people to run a scientific meeting in the United States now because the visa situation remains problematic for people around the world to go. So it's definitely taken a big chunk out of the U.S.'s huge competitive advantage. The groups that work in the United States, there's a whole bunch of things they do about creating tools and activities that the whole world plays around with.
Yeah.
And so in astronomy, we rely on the U.S. to do a lot of things. For example, climate change, but in astronomy, it's, you know, who keeps track of where the asteroids are moving around the solar system? Well, it turns out to be NASA. And, you know, if NASA's not doing that, someone better pick it up or we're liable to get hit, you know, accident, you know, without knowing about it sometime in the future. So there's this whole hunks of infrastructure that are really dependent in science, and not just astronomy, all areas, on the United States because it's such a big bit. So is their loss our gain? Well, only if you think it's okay for all boats to go down and our boat to rise a little bit relative to the biggest boat. I don't think that's a great thing. But we need to be very conscious of what China is doing in all of this as well. I mean, China is investing very consistently in science across the board. And their capability is rising rapidly. Mm. And
massive investment, something like nearly over 8%
GDP. It's consistent, okay? So you don't have this chaos of people saying, I don't know what to do. So it's consistent. And you can see them beginning to overtake in certain areas. And to the level that the economy and, quite frankly, your, you know, geopolitical heft is related to your research capability, this over the next 20 years could really, really change things as we're used to it. And I don't quite know how it's going to play out.
And that there's a security issue here too for you. I'm not pinpointing China in particular, but more about your argument around sovereign research capability in a world that is experiencing immense tumult. That is vital from your perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of these things where we need to have enough at the table where we can work with the best people in the world and use and bring what we need here. And in a world where suddenly our, you know, closest collaborators start becoming very hard to work with, and we're going to either have to pivot to new people or, quite frankly, miss out on a lot of what's going on.
Mm. I mean, careers have also fallen over because of what's happening in America. It's quite tragic for early career scientists. Rolf?
I fully agree with you, Brian, because I think the whole discussion has also, let's call it, a cultural element. I mean, to do science, find out how things work, is one of the most important and enjoyable activities of humankind. I'm biased, you know. But still, it's a lot of fun, it's interesting, and if such interference, you know, increases, we lose that enormous freedom of thinking.
Mm.
Because I think to find a niche where you feel you can make a difference is an enormous privilege.
Mm.
And it's very important to keep a young person going with the head through the wall.
Swiss immunologist Rolf Zinkernagel, who won the 1996 Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine. He's still scaling those Swiss mountains, I gather, at age 82. His co-winner, Peter Doherty, and Nobel laureate in physics, Brian Schmidt, are with me on Big Ideas Today, ABC Radio National, coming to you from a packed Llewellyn Hall at the Australian National University. But this is at the heart, too, of what makes universities like this university so fundamental to civilised societies, democratic societies. And so, Peter Doherty, what we've also seen is this incredible increase in mistrust around expertise.
Yes.
And as part of that, a loss of trust in science and scientists.
A lot of it's social media. I mean, by definition, to the conspiracy theorists, if you're someone who has real expertise in an area and you actually know that area well and you're a practitioner, well, you can't be trusted because you're making money out of it. Therefore, you're just doing this to improve your own situation, which is crazy. I mean, your sort of story that all paediatricians are corrupt because and are pushing vaccines. I mean, paediatricians care passionately about the health of children. They're not there to make children sick, unlike Robert F. Kennedy, who's trying to kill them by taking vaccines away. I mean, you know, it's honestly crazy. It's the classical catch 22. It's Yusarian
I mean, it's easy to laugh about it, but it's profoundly consequential,
no,
isn't it?
I was on social media a lot through COVID. I had more than 100,000 followers.
How'd that go for you?
Well, largely due to a tweet about what a Dan Murphy's opening hour.
I had more Twitter followers until you made that tweet.
I had a lot of followers. And you know, there were people who didn't believe viruses existed. It was insane.
Did you engage? How did you see your responsibility as a scientist?
I tried for a while, but you find it's absolutely hopeless, and it's totally wearing. It's totally wearing. You can't do much about it. I've gone off social media completely. It just exhausted me.
But we have to admit that if people, the general public, do not know what a virus is, it's our fault.
It's not. I mean, biology is pretty well taught in schools and so forth. What is it that goes wrong? I mean, it's...
Many things, I think.
You're a science communicator.
Well, journalist.
There's just...
same thing.
Different.
Misinformation.
I'm not responsible.
Yeah, so misinformation has come through an amazing, you know, turn of events in the last 10 years. And so we're in a place pre 10, 15 years ago where information was curated. Media was curated, the library was curated, politicians could not go out and say outlandish things. there were consequences for them when they said outlandish things. There are none now because the curation of knowledge has been broken down where everyone gets to choose their own version of reality because all realities are out there. And if it isn't, you put it out there and say, no, this is what I think the universe is like. And that fragmentation of knowledge, I think, has had profound consequences for how people interact with information.
Mm. And I mean, it's been a democratizing force as well. So it's an interesting tension there,
so
isn't it?
I would not call it, it is democratizing, but it's not necessarily good. It's, you know, we as humans have worked not as individuals. We actually work as groups and we collectively make decisions. And the whole way that humanity's built itself up is by sharing knowledge from 400 years ago. So not everyone has to reinvent everything. We share knowledge. And there was a curation process. That curation has been broken down by the internet and the way information is stored.
Mm. Yeah. Peter.
I published a sort of warts and all book about science, trying to explain science to people who don't even like science.
Back The
Knowledge Wars.
Fantastic
back in 2015.
Book. The Knowledge Wars. Fantastic.
And one of the chapters was about deliberate ignorance and invented narrative. Now, why did I get into that? It's because I was looking at medical science from the point of view of an insider and climate science from the point of view of an outsider. Brian has also been very active in the climate science space and trying to get action. And basically, what we were seeing there is deliberate ignorance. Tony Abbott, for instance, would not meet with climate science.
So for Rolf's benefit, former Prime Minister of Australia, Liberal Party.
So he's not a bad guy. He's quite likeable, actually, when you meet him, but he would just not meet with climate science. He wouldn't talk to them. So that's deliberate ignorance. And what we've seen is this enormous amount of money poured in to discredit the whole area of science. And I think that's degraded public trust in science.
Well, it's become politically inconvenient for some people to use science as a policy tool.
Up till then, just about all the science that happened gave things that people liked. All the toys, and I mean, the computer, the cell phone, all these toys we love so much. And suddenly, here's science coming along and say, hey, we have to step back. Maybe we have to take some things away. Maybe we really can't do that. We don't accept that. I mean, we're apes with big brains. We love our toys.
We do indeed. Rolf.
But I think I fully agree. It's important to note that science and research finds out how things work and how far things go. But it's politics, it's the society who will decide what to apply it for and what to use. And I think we have to accept that full-heartedly. I don't agree with many popular votes in Switzerland, particularly, for example, where what concerns animal experimentation. But at the end, I think our task is, and that's what the public finances us for, is to find out how does it work and how far does it go.
Interesting. Brian.
Yeah, so Rolf's made a very important point. Ultimately, the public and the politicians who they elect do make decisions on science, and that's the way it should be. But what I'm worried about is that the information they're getting is no longer full and reasonable information. It's highly distorted, and I think that's because we've lost control of information. And, you know, media is in Australia literally the least trusted institution. It's behind even politicians.
Well, the media is many institutions.
I understand.
Just to be
but
clear.
As opposed to the political institution, it's a real problem.
Yeah, it is a problem. It is a problem. So let's come to some possible solutions from our three Nobel laureates on the stage, because if you were politicians, I'd be curious to know what decisions you made. But as people invested in university culture, as people who have been very invested in mentoring the next generation of scientists, of building incredible teams of innovators and scientific creatives, as people who have raised children and so thought closely about how children should be educated, how can you advocate as scientists for change? What power do you think you've got?
I think there are several ways. One is to up education in biomedical, physical and so on science. And the reason, this is very interesting, you know, there are certain professions that somehow always lean to the left. And certain things are simply negated because it's uncomfortable. So I think open teaching of all things is the base for everything. Now, you can't change or select your parents. And the parents, of course, are very instrumental in choosing also science. It's not by chance that, for example, the whole measles vaccine discussion was basically triggered by the Steiner schools and the Pentecostals. So, you know, we have to account for all these various beliefs and misbeliefs and so on. But at the end, I think we must publish and communicate that measles can be one in a thousand cause a chronic brain disease. If you vaccinate, that chance is one in a million.
Mm.
Now, you can't argue with these numbers. And I think
people do, don't they? Yeah, yep. That's the challenge. People do argue with the numbers because they don't understand the power of the numbers.
Well, you have to be numerate for a start. I mean, that's a part of the problem.
Yeah, so, this is the trick. So Brian, priorities for the coming time.
So let's talk about how science, what science can do ourselves, okay? I think we need to become brutally transparent. I mean, like a level of transparency where it's just all out there and that's part of the deal, okay?
Tricky for industry-sponsored science.
It needs to be brutal, transparent on everything. It doesn't mean that you don't do industry-sponsored science, but it's all out there. That the way experiments are done, all these things are just done in sort of an open-source thing.
Radical transparency.
Yeah, radical transparency. So I think that's a really important thing. But we still have this problem, which is the human brain, with its sort of type 1, type 2 thinking, type 1 thinking being that really rapid one that Danny Kahneman won his Nobel Prize understanding, is manipulatable through bad information. And it can be kind of tweaked, and it is being tweaked right now and creating huge amounts of really disaffected people who don't believe anything. And it's classic Russian propaganda techniques. The Germans used it in World War II. It works, and that's just the way humans are. We're not very. So we're going to need, I think, the political class. The people need to do their best to elect trustworthy people and accept the fact that trustworthy people are going to tell them things that not everyone's a winner, not everyone can get what they want, that there's going to be some hard choices.
So bringing gravitas instead of populism.
Yeah, so we need to go away from the populism, and you got to think as a system. But how do we get voters to do that? I honestly don't know. And I'm certainly not the one to try to figure out how to get politics to work well. It's kind of an alien culture to me.
I think, you know, young people are very engaged with climate change. And so that's...
But they're not with maths and science as much.
No, they're not with maths and science.
So that's interesting. I think there's an assumption that AI can do it all sometimes.
Yeah, and I wish I could convince more young people to go into areas like engineering and so forth where they may be actually able to do something about it rather than just speculate about it. But I, you know, I, and talking to young to students and young people and so forth, I always try and emphasize, you know, be a communicator. Don't spend a lot of time on it, but if you've got some great experiment, put it on YouTube. If you've got insights, I mean, put it out in social media, talk to people. And
interact.
Stuff. Interact. I mean, one of the best things I did since I've been at the University of Melbourne in some small way was help get the conversation started,
which
has been a great source of information. It's not working perfectly, but it's getting good stuff
it's
out
phenomenal.
There.
It's phenomenal, yeah. I know people who read the conversation over reading the news.
And it's a totally new thing. It was thought up by a former newspaper editor, Andrew Jaspin, who's an interesting guy. But I think we've got to have it much more grassroots. And people talking to each other. You know, we make all sorts of assumptions about attitudes in the bush, for instance. I mean, it looks really weird. The bush, which is most affected by climate change, seems to be, so many people seem to be against action to do something about it. But what's the reality of that? I mean, if you talk to people, what are they really talking about? Often we don't know. We make assumptions.
Mm.
And we need a lot more journalism, but unfortunately no one's going to pay for it.
Ah, there's the challenge. Hey, to wrap the conversation, I just want to ask all of you, each of you, what scientific question, mystery, would you love to see answered before you die? And you're not about to die anytime soon, so just, you know, you can think long term here, but just, you know, in your lifetime, we all die, folks, it's okay. But in your lifetime, what scientific problem would you like to see answered? Mystery that you or your community, it might be in your field or it might be beyond your field. Peter?
Well, it's not a mystery, but I'd like to see us getting some way of slowing down these protein folding diseases like Alzheimer's disease and so forth. I mean, this is a tremendous toll. It's a tremendous tragedy. I think some things are going to happen. They're going to happen quickly. We're going to get a lot with the combination of modern technology and AI, we're going to see a lot of new cancer treatments emerge, a lot more specific things. Unfortunately, though, this can often make medicine much more expensive, which is a real problem for us. But I think it's those chronic degenerative dementias that if we could give people good quality of life until we shuffle off the mortal coil. I mean, I don't want to see people live forever. I mean, we can all name people we don't want to see live forever.
Not you three, thank you very much. Rolf, what about you?
I have two answers. You know, one, what I really want to know is how vaccines work. Because...
Well, I tried to tell you.
And the reason why I say that is the following. There are two categories of vaccines. One category, you vaccinate once and you are covered for all your life, 80 years. And there are many others that you have to repeat every 4 or 5 years. So, you know, why? Why is that difference? I'm sure if we would understand that, we would be much better.
Mm.
And the second issue is what Peter said. You know, I think the biggest problem our human society has today is our longevity. We are too many humans and we are getting too stupid too quickly for too long. And that is a huge problem, because just remember, to keep one Alzheimer patient reasonably happy and healthy, you need 2 to 3 full-time employees. Now, the speculation goes by 90, at least a third of our population has some of these degenerative chronic type of neurological diseases. And the calculation is very simple. So that problem cannot be solved unless we as a society decide on how to use knowledge and medicine.
Mm.
very difficult. I don't say that's easy, but I think that's a big, big challenge.
Very interesting ethical minefield to tease us with at the end of this conversation. Gee, I'd love to talk to you more about that. Brian Schmidt.
Well, I mean, as an astronomer, I, you know, helped discover dark energy. We have no idea what dark energy is. It's 70% of the universe. I'd love to know what that is, but it seems almost too hard of a question. So we have dark matter, which is 25% of the universe. We don't know what that is either. That seems...
And yet it does so much.
Yeah, well, it has gravity, but it goes right through us. So it does very little. It just goes right through us, but does more than dark energy, which is just sort of everywhere. So dark, understanding what dark matter is strikes me as something that could be discovered anytime. But it hasn't. And it hasn't for, you know, 70 or 80 years now. So on my astronomy side, understanding what dark matter would be, that would be a real top ask. I'm less worried about health issues. I mean, I am personally invested in not having these issues we've talked about. But for the human species, I can kind of live with it. So I'm more worried societally about how we manage AI's interaction with humans. So I could imagine, you know, AI-enabled robots doing a lot of Alzheimer's work. But I could also imagine it making the human race really stupid because none of us learn what we need to because it does all the work for us.
Even obsolete might make us obsolete.
But I continue to worry about how we're going to manage energy. And so, for example, coming up with a solar to liquid fuel. That would be really, really amazing if we could do that. And you could literally sort of create oil, except for it would be greenhouse gas neutral. Something like that would be amazing. But it does not seem to happen. So it's got to chemically be very, very challenging to do sensibly.
It is surreal to think that we're still digging up, you know, we're still sucking petrol, you know, fuel out of the earth, putting it into our cars, burning it. And
well,
turning it into emissions. It's kind of bizarre.
Worth of plant life
2025, that's what, 26, sorry, that's what we're doing.
I always find it extraordinary that an A320 Airbus is driven by something equivalent to a primer stove. You know, it's a fossil fuel driving this incredible technological feat.
But the thing that I'd love the answer to is the fate of the universe. And I think your Nobel laureate, your Nobel win is the finding that's most given me existential angst, this idea that the universe is expanding in an ever-accelerating way. What is the end point? What does the end point look like?
Well, I would have said very confidently a year ago that the universe gets bigger and bigger, faster and faster, and eventually everything in the universe is separated from everything else, and it's just a big void where we're kind of all alone, even literally in the fullness of time at the, you know, atomic level. But it may be that dark energy is changing, and so we actually don't know what's going to happen.
So maybe we'll all coalesce again.
Yeah, well, so I'm not sure that's better. I think the Gnab Gib, things crunching together, I'm not sure I like that better than the thing that lasts forever.
And so on that wonderful existential note, it's wonderful that you've all been here. Please thank our special guests tonight, Rob Zinkernagel, Brian Schmidt, Peter Doherty. Thanks to the Australian National University and Swiss Embassy for organising today's event with Nobel laureates astrophysicist Brian Schmidt, immunologists Peter Doherty and Rolf Zinkernagel. A pretty good day in the office, you could say. I'm Natasha Mitchell and this is Big Ideas, bringing you big thinkers, the biggest of thinkers from live stages everywhere. Find and follow Big Ideas on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Our email address, bigideas@abc.net.au if you want to get in touch, and I'm on all the socials. And to be in the audience of a live recording with me, head to the Big Ideas homepage, scroll on down, look for Be In Our Audience. Next on the show, empires. They rise, they fall. Historian Sam Dalrymple from the Ubud Writers' Festival in Bali joins us. Yes, he is William Dalrymple's son, whose Empire podcast I'm learning a hell of a lot from at the moment. I'll catch you then. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.